Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
When Admiral Jonathan Richardson took over as Chief of Naval Operations late last year, he insisted on some changes to the Navy's vocabulary. In particular, he's not a fan of the word dominance. And so, for example, Vice Admiral Ted Branch is now the Chief of Information Warfare instead of the Chief of Information Dominance. Branch spoke with Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu at the Sea Air Space Conference about what that switch to information warfare means for the broader Navy.
Well, what we're really talking about is warfare in the information age. And the practitioners of information warfare that we used to call the Information Dominance Corps, we really did the logical step of rebranding them to the information warfare community. Mm-hmm. And the practice that they pursue is information warfare as opposed to a pursuit of information dominance. We've been thinking about doing that for some time. It makes more sense to a lot of people when we speak in terms of information warfare and the information warfare community. Admiral Richardson didn't like the term dominance in any field,
right,
and not just information but others, because he, in his words, he thought it implied we're finished, pencils down, we're dominant. And he recognizes quite correctly that we're far from dominant in this space. It's something that we have to continue to work and evolve and get better at.
As a practical matter, does it change the way the community operates or the way that you think about what is now called warfare?
No, not the way this community thinks about warfare, but it helps us be more recognizable to the rest of the Navy when we put it in terms of information warfare and not information dominance. We're elevating information as a warfighting domain that's analogous to undersea, surface, air, space warfare. And in fact, our position is that if we don't get it right in the information domain, which includes electromagnetic spectrum maneuver warfare and cyber, if we don't get it right there, then what we do in those other domains with aviation, surface, undersea, probably won't matter, because the fight will be lost before it's ever joined.
Right. And I know CNO has given you a new project called, I believe, Task Force Netted Navy. Can you talk about what your tasking is there and what are you going to be doing?
My first meeting with CNO Greenert when he was taking over, he asked me the question, Twig, who's in charge of making sure that everything can talk to everything else? Mm. And I said, well, CNO, I guess that would be me, but we're not very good at doing that right now. There are a lot of several efforts about integration and interoperability of systems to weapons, to sensors, to platforms, but they weren't a collective effort. They were in pockets, and it was not a broad reach. So what we've done just recently, it's very new, is stood up a task force. It's being led by an SES on the staff, Margie Palmieri, who's gathering experts from across the domain to talk about what the drivers are that will drive data standards and make everything talk to everything else. So the theoretical limit of that would be any weapon could be targeted with data from any sensor, and that the network nodes would be able to work to get the information from one to the other. That's a big reach from where we are now, but that's where we're trying to go in terms of architecture and standards and specifications to allow that kind of connectivity to exist.
And important, I think, that integration is not just about IT, it's about everything and every portfolio. So what are the biggest barriers to achieving that vision, you think?
Well, obviously there are a lot of silos of excellence, you know, in the different programs and the different warfare areas. And all those people are coming into this team to work their piece of the puzzle. The other thing is, we didn't build the programs with that necessarily in mind, and there's no new money into the program. You know, the program manager looks at that and they say, okay, well, I'm happy to work on that. Where do I get the extra money to add into this old program to do that? Mm-hmm. So we'll have to cross that hurdle and decide how we can adjust programmatically what's already in the program to enable that kind of perhaps modification or perhaps some kind of interpretive capability between systems to allow that connectivity.
And so would you see the task force at some point transitioning into some kind of permanent organization that is the clearinghouse for data standards across the entire Navy?
I think that would be a logical next step. We won't preordain that. The task force has 4 months to report out on where we need to go as a way ahead, and they started their work this week. So we'll see where they go in 4 months and see what the logical next steps are. I wouldn't be surprised if there was some kind of organization set up among the systems commands and acquisition authorities to continue this path into the future. Mm.
And another task force we've talked about before is the former Task Force Cyber Awakening, which has now become the permanent cybersecurity division within your office within the last year, really. Talk about what you think were the most important takeaways from TIFCA, and to what extent has Navy cybersecurity started to address some of those findings?
Well, TIFCA was started in a bit of a, I'll stop short of saying crisis, but we had a watershed event that caused us to stand up the task force. And the reason we initiated the task force was there were a lot of efforts, a lot of work in the Navy working on cybersecurity, but they were disjointed efforts and not focused. So Task Force Cyber Awakening was designed as a lens, a focusing mechanism to bring all those efforts together and move down the same path. We started with the network, the outer wall of the network, and shoring that up to counter that situation that caused us to kick it off. We did that with a lot of commercial technology, and that gave us some space and time to look deeper in the network, and we found quickly that we had needs for sensing and segmentation and the ability to fight within the network to inhibit or to instill resilience. So, like industry, we use the protect, detect, react, restore model for resilience in our networks, the ability to segment those networks, sense what's going on in there, and then fight through any kind of bad action that's going on and continue to execute the mission. The Navy Cybersecurity Division is a follow-on to that effort. It collected good people from various entities to continue that work. And it's a lot about standards and specifications and designing in cybersecurity instead of bolting it on after the fact.
And so I think one of the end goals there is for those super critical systems to be able to declare them, as you say, cyber safe, a la subsafe. Are we at the point yet where some of those systems have reached that level?
We are going down the path of cyber safe. The Information Assurance, Information Technology, Technical Advisory Board, the IAIT TAB, is in the business of creating specifications and standards for cyber safe systems. They are well down that path, and all the different systems commands, we've had CyberSafe office test drives. Each systems command will have their own CyberSafe organization, and we've proven out the concept, we've proven out the procedures and the way we will do business. We've started down the path of establishing those standards, so the program is ready to run, and in fact has started running. We haven't finished the standards, but we're I think 3 of 5 CyberSafe standards complete, and then about 20 of 40 cybersecurity standards are complete now out of the IAIT TAB.
Got it. Okay. In our last couple minutes here, I wanted to talk about cyber effects. I wasn't able to listen to your talk yesterday, but some of the accounts of it quote you as talking about the fact that the authority to use cyber effects is at a pretty high level right now. What are the questions that you think need sorting out in terms of authorities as this domain of warfare continues to mature?
Well, what I said yesterday is it's obvious to me our future will entail cyber effects through the RF spectrum, the ability to do that. Mm-hmm. And we have equipment that we're putting on ships and platforms, planes, other things that will enable those kinds of activities. So then the question becomes, at that tactical level, will the unit commander, the operational to tactical commander, have the authority to, say, fire right. and create that effect? That's work to be done. Right now, we haven't evolved to that point, and the cyber authorities for offensive cyber effects are held at a very high level in the organization, even in the government. So that's policy, really policy work that has to continue to mature that concept. The other thing that I said yesterday is there is a temporal aspect between electronic warfare and cybersecurity. Electronic warfare and cyber, offensive cyber. I think if you have an effect created in real time, either by a burst of energy or by a packet of information, you can pretty much lump that into electronic warfare as opposed to cyber. So there's some definitional work that has to be done there about where that line, that blurred line, should be drawn, and then who can order that effect.
Vice Admiral Ted Branch is the Navy's Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Warfare, speaking with Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu at the Sea Air Space Conference in National Harbor, Maryland. Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages.
Listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
From fighters to carriers to submarines, the Navy wants to network its weapon system so their warfighting capability is greater than the sum of its parts. That task falls to Rear Admiral Michael Manazer, who was appointed just last week as the Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Warfare Systems. Before that, he was director of the Navy's Air Warfare Division. Manazer spoke to Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu at the annual Sea Air Space Conference in National Harbor, Maryland.
Thanks for the opportunity, by the way. And my new role is very exciting because the concepts that we were thinking about in naval aviation, a systems of systems approach, an integrated warfare approach, integration and interoperability approach, and have capabilities that are across all of our platforms, vice just a platform approach, is the way that I am approaching, I used to approach about 50 times there, is the way that I am looking at all of our weapon systems. The ability to take what we have and connect them together so that we can all share the same picture, we can all share the same understanding of the battle space is the focus that I have. And so instead of arguing for a certain number of strike fighters, a certain number of ships, how do I take the capability that we've already bought and take it to a higher level? How do I get close to the technological limit of the technology that we have and then add the man-machine teaming piece in there to understand where machine speed can help, kind of like technology does for us now with innovation and commercial industry, and where the man is in the decide or act mode. So you have a man-machine team that gives you a greater synergy of what the systems we have out there. And I think that applies across all of the domains, including cyber information domain.
And as far as all of those questions that you just laid out, to what extent does that thinking apply to platforms that the Navy already owns, and how does it impact the way that you go acquire things
in the future?
I believe
we need to energize a different set of questions. We have programs of record that have been produced on a basis of requirements that is stayed and founded on a JSIDS process at DoD 5000. As we look at those programs going forward, we have to be able to ask questions: how would we make this program of record a greater capability by combining innovation and technology to improve that? We have to ask those questions. We can't just stay in the, this is our program because that was the requirement. Or somebody says, when I ask, how do we put innovation into this or a new technology into this, they say, well, you don't have a requirement for that based on that foundation. We have to break that paradigm of the initial set of requirements driving this program of record, and we have to continue to ask those questions about why it costs this much, why it takes this long, why we can't take advantage of gaming technology, why we can't take advantage of augmented reality, virtual reality, those kind of things that industry is stretching into. How do we apply artificial intelligence to the things that now we have a machine that where the man is could be so much greater in that man-machine team?
CNO, the new CNO, as everyone knows by now, has his design for maintaining maritime superiority. How does your previous role in aviation play into that, and now your N9 role play into that?
What I do with the CNO's design is I channel his view of the design and the four lines of effort we have into warfighting capability. I translate where we want to go forward with these concepts of systems architecture, and with this concept of innovation and technology, this concept of faster learning teams into the equipment and capability that gives us that design. The warfighting instantiation of that design is my effort. So primarily, what we call the blue line of effort to strengthen power at and from the sea. That is primarily where the N9's focus, where my focus lies, in order to take his concepts and apply them to real warfighting. The challenge for me is to grab a hold of the technical limit of technology out there, to grab a hold of those good ideas in industry and pull them into the thinking processes we have to do just that.
You mentioned live virtual construction constructive training, I think, in the context of integrating various warfare systems. To what extent does that also help you address some of the readiness challenges that everyone's facing with decreased flight hours in actual cockpits?
Thanks, Jared. I think it actually applies across all of that. So the ability to go out and have an immersive environment that you can really replicate most of the flight training that we have, with the exception of the G that you pull, the physiological environment, is very powerful for us. So we can shape more of our training into a simulated or immersive environment and reduce those flying hour dollars. That's the readiness piece. Second, our high-end warfight requires us to be able to take these things into a simulated environment. We can't practice in the open air. We can't divulge our capabilities, and so we have to go into a simulated or immersive environment. And then the other thing about the reach of our networks now is geographically extends beyond the boundaries of our current ranges. And so necessarily we have to go into the virtual constructive environment to be able to create virtual battle space. I can, through a virtual constructive connection between the West Coast at Fallon, Nevada, for instance, and maybe either Oceania or down at Key West, I can connect a battle force, you know, across country via this virtual network, and we have that capability now. The biggest challenge I have with live virtual constructive is, in order to take data off of the airplanes that are flying live, I have to have an NSA-certified waveform to take that data off a high-end airplane and move it down to the site. So that's my greatest technological hurdle, is to be able to move that data off a live platform so I can fight that live platform with his virtual wingman who's down in a ground facility. But that LVC applies across our from our readiness all the way to our high-end training capability, and that's where we're trying to build that to a higher level.
Last question, sir, because I know you got to run, but also on readiness, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee has zeroed in on the issue of aviation mishaps, particularly in the Marine Corps, but in all the services, really, positing that the higher accident rate is connected directly to fewer training hours. I wonder how that picture looks to you in the Navy. Is there a higher mishap rate, first of all, and is it directly connected to decreases in readiness funding?
So so the Naval Safety Center does a very good job of doing root cause analysis for all of our mishaps. And we have determined over years of flight training through just data analysis that when you have a monthly hour per pilot rate of 11 hours a month, if you get below that across the force or in a squadron, your mishap rate goes up. And so in the United States Navy, we call that the tactical hard deck. Mm. And so when we're training to all of our missions, we determine that 11 hours a month is our tactical hard deck. That's something we don't want to go below. If we do go below that tactical hard deck, of course, and we have less hours for that, then the commanding officers have to manage what missions the air crew are doing in each of those hours they go flying. We have to determine the risk assessment and risk management of the tasks that we're giving the pilots to go do as part of their training. If you have a pilot who is not proficient in his cockpit because he hasn't flown over a bunch of times, then you probably don't want to send him out to do a high-end, very complex mission where he has a lot of heads-down time in the cockpit, either day or night. And so commanding officers are managing those risk tasks. I cannot currently connect our readiness level of funding with an increased or decreased mishap rate. The Safety Center does that for both the Navy and the Marine Corps. I can't speak for the Marine Corps at all about their rates, but for the Navy, we do have a correlation of that. It is very clear that our readiness funding is not where it needs to be. We have been on the Hill testifying that we're too low in funding for readiness. We have critically underfunded a lot of our enabler accounts, which underpin the actual flying hours we're given, and we've testified that funding needs to come up for us to be able to properly manage that high-end risk to do those high-end missions as we go forward, so we'll be truly ready to go.
All right, I'll leave it there, Admiral. Thanks so much for talking
with us. Thanks,
Jared.
Appreciate it.
Rear Admiral Michael Manazer is the new Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Warfare Systems, speaking there with Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu at the annual Sea Air Space Conference at National Harbor. Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.